You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Hello, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends. You're listening to Back in the USSR on CFRU. I am Siegfried. I realize my attendance record has been a little spotty over the course of this past month, and I want to thank you for bearing with me on that. But I am live in the studio now, and more or less fresh out of the demonstration in downtown Guelph that I participated in yesterday against the expansion of the Kinder Morgan tar sands oil pipeline, which is now being built on stolen and indigenous land in BC. OPIRG was there, the Gap Action Group was there, the Guelph Young Communist League was there, Guelph and District Labor Council was there. We marched from the boathouse all the way to MP Lloyd Longfield's office on Cork Street. We actually took the street on Macdonnell downtown and also made our presence felt outside the downtown branch of the TD Bank, a bank that has extensive investments in the BC pipeline projects and the Alberta tar sands. We assembled outside the MP's office. We delivered our message, which is an actual bottle of water from the BC watershed affected by the Kinder Morgan pipeline. And several of us spoke and spoke powerfully, not only against the pipeline itself and its corporate backers, but against the corporate state in Canada that makes it possible. That makes land theft possible, that makes environmental devastation possible. And those speakers were adamant that this state, this colonial state, needs to be broken down. The colonial system needs to be dismantled. It needs to be smashed. It needs to be overcome. Because radical transformative change and revolution is the only way that Indigenous peoples and the land can receive justice. There can be no justice under a system where profits are in command, and where the endless expansion of profit is the bottom line in government and in society. This is especially true with regard to the environment and environmental justice, which was the focus of the demonstration, and it must be understood that the struggle to protect the water, the air, the soil, and so on is inextricably linked and bound up with the struggle against capitalism and colonialism, both in this country and around the world. And really, that's what tonight's show is going to be about. Now, our demonstration in Guelph is only one of dozens which took place across the country on Friday in solidarity with those activists and Indigenous land defenders who put their bodies on the line to physically block and obstruct the construction of the Kinder Morgan pipeline in BC. 130 of them were arrested this week, including elderly men and women, as the police moved in to protect the capitalists and their investments, as is their job in a capitalist society where profits are in command. You know, they're not there to protect the people. They are there to protect profit, and that's what the police did. And that was reflected in how physical they got in arresting the demonstrators. They got very physical indeed. Very aggressive. And this is what one of the protesters, Indigenous activist Clayton Thomas Mueller, had to say about what happened. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
This is Dimitri Lascaris reporting for The Real News from Montreal, Canada. In Burnaby, British Columbia, it is the fourth day of resistance in what has been dubbed the Standing Rock of the North. The target of this resistance is the proposed $7 billion doubling of the Trans Mountain Kinder Morgan pipeline to carry dirty tar sands oil from Alberta to the British Columbia coast through the Burrard Inlet of North Vancouver. More than 60 people have now been arrested, including a former Trans Mountain environmental engineer, Romilly Cavanaugh. During similar actions conducted Saturday through Sunday, Tuesday, the arrests are ongoing. These actions follow the March 10th Protect the Inlet March, where thousands of people rallied against the pipeline and tanker project. Resistance is growing. In Canada, a national day of action has been called for this Friday against the Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion. Now here to discuss the resistance with us is Clayton Thomas Mueller. Clayton is a member of the Treaty 6-based Matthias Colomb Cree Nation, also known as Pukatawagan, located in northern Manitoba, Canada. And based in Winnipeg, Clayton is the Stop It at the Source campaigner with 350.org. He joins us today from Winnipeg. Thanks very much for coming back on The Real News, Clayton.
Hey, thanks for having me, and hello to the viewers.
Clayton, let's start by talking about the injunction that has been issued by the British Columbia Court in relation to the construction site at the Kinder Morgan facility. What, in essence, does that injunction say?
Well, the injunction stipulates that anyone who violates the 5-meter barrier of the Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain and Tanker Farm facility there in Burnaby Mountain, would be subject to a civil contempt charge. This is a non-criminal charge with two conditions, which are that A, they're not allowed to again violate the 5-meter zone, nor are they allowed to block traffic coming in or out of the gates there at Kinder Morgan's facilities. Over the last many days of rolling peaceful, nonviolent direct actions, we've seen over 60 people, be arrested, doing just that. And I think that, right now, as I speak to you, there are people facing arrest today, again, putting their bodies on the line to stop the Trans Mountain pipeline from being constructed.
Now, you yourself are one of the persons who was arrested at Burnaby Mountain. What were you doing when you were arrested, and how did the police treat you And also, have you been charged with any offense? And if so, what is the charge?
No. Well, yes, I was one of the first 26 people to risk arrest last Saturday. And, you know, I was arrested. I did sign a promise to appear, you know, which of course provided a couple of conditions of which I'm not supposed to break, or I would face more severe charges. So, you know, I along with many others will be appearing at some point in early June, you know, through representation, of course, in the BC courts.
And at the time of your arrest, you were at, I take it, within the 5-meter barrier, or is this something you're not at liberty to talk about?
No, we were right there at the gate, the primary gate. There are a few entrances into the construction site where they're clearing trees to make way for the right-of-way of the proposed Trans Mountain pipeline. And, you know, we rolled in there after, you know, participating in ceremony at the Watch House, a traditional structure raised by the Tsleil-Waututh elders. You know, this is a very old tradition where when the nation would be threatened, they would erect these watch houses to keep an eye on their enemies. So we stopped at the watch house there at the fence of Kinder Morgan's construction site, participated in a prayer and invocation by local indigenous groups, and then proceeded to march to the gate, invoking the spirit of the civil rights movement, and then locked ourselves down to the gate using industrial zip ties, which then provoked a response from Kinder Morgan, who called in the RCMP to enforce the injunction.
Now, according to the RCMP, there was reported on CBC today about this, three officers suffered minor injuries while making arrests on Monday against evening of demonstrators at the site of the expansion. And the Mounties say that one officer suffered a head injury after being kicked, another suffered a knee injury, and a third injured a hand. They seem to be relatively minor injuries. But is there a concern that, you know, as a result of these sorts of things, that the police may become increasingly aggressive and potentially force some kind of a violent confrontation, such as, you know, the kind of aggression perhaps that we saw at Standing Rock? Are there fears about that? Any signs that that might happen?
You know, I think one of the things that proponents of this pipeline and also, you know, the federal government who approved this project early in the Trudeau administration fear is a Standing Rock type situation. You know, the police did report injuries in their enforcement of the injunction last night. But that said, you know, the media, the Canadian press, as well as the CBC reported, you know, that they failed to report, rather, that these arrests happened outside of the injunction zone, actually in the crosswalk region in front of the property. You know, and I think that RCMP you know, also neglected to mention how incredibly escalated their arrest tactics were. You know, they were very aggressive, you know, against peaceful, nonviolent, very passive, you know, land defenders, water defenders. And, you know, I think there is a bit of sensationalization with the aim of criminalizing peaceful dissent in the actions of the local police stemming from yesterday's arrests. And of course, you know, the media and proponents of the pipeline are running with that with the sole purpose of criminalizing peaceful dissent and criminalizing the actions of Indigenous peoples, which are not protests. They are quite simply assertions of territorial jurisdiction well within the means of the nation-to-nation relationship they have with the federal government of Canada.
Well, this is Dimitri Lascaris. I've been speaking to Clayton Thomas Mueller of 350.org about a major series of resistance actions at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia, against the Trans Mountain pipeline expansion. Thank you very much for joining us again, Clayton, and we will be sure to follow the story as it unfolds.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this has been The Real News from Montreal, Canada.
Okay, so that was Clayton Thomas Mueller on The Real News. That was on Friday, actually, they aired that interview. Now, It has to be said that the Canadian government under Justin Trudeau has a truly amazing track record of saying one thing and doing something else entirely. At the last round of global climate talks in Paris, he promised the world that that Canada would take a leading role in cutting greenhouse gas emissions. And he followed up on that by dramatically escalating government support for the oil and gas sector, the tar sands, and the pipelines. Things that are not compatible, needless to say, with fighting climate change, let alone his vapid promises of reconciliation with Indigenous peoples, which have likewise been betrayed. I mean, the Salish and other Indigenous nations in BC and across the country have been struggling tooth and nail to defend what in many cases is completely unceded Indigenous territory against the fossil fuel industry and the capitalist state that backs it, you know, backs it to the hilt with armed force, for that matter. This is not reconciliation. This is colonialism and colonial warfare against colonized people. And of course, the people are resisting. You know, they and their allies are resisting. You know, with their bodies, they're at Burnaby Mountain, they're at, you know, sites across the nation. Just as they were in Standing Rock in the U.S. Facing off, like trying to block the Keystone XL pipeline, you know, last year. And that, of course, like faced incredible repression and violence from the state in the United States. You know, and the chances are very good that, that sort of thing will happen here. You know, it's only a matter of time. And just to show you how hand in glove the Canadian government is with the fossil fuel industry, I want to play this documentary from the Real News Network from last fall, which is aptly titled, Is the oil industry Canada's deep state? Is the oil industry Canada's deep state? Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Last week, the government of the Canadian province of British Columbia announced it was introducing new regulations which would halt the expansion of a pipeline connecting Alberta's oil sands to the Pacific Ocean. This immediately triggered a political war between the governments of Alberta, led by Premier Rachel Notley, and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on one side, and the government of British Columbia on the other. Notley threatened legal action and other economic penalties against BC.
BC's actions are unconstitutional.
While Trudeau promised the pipeline would be built.
Moving forward is approving the Kinder Morgan pipeline, which will be able to get our resources responsibly and safely to new markets across the Pacific.
The dominant influence of the oil industry in Canadian politics, as seen in the reactions of Trudeau and Notley, has been likened by some to a state within the state.
The oil industry, the oil deep state in Canada is powerful.
Kevin Taft, a former leader of Alberta's Liberal Party, has written a book making this case.
My argument is that over 25 years or so, the oil industry has worked very hard to gain influence through various means over the federal level, over Environment Canada, over Natural Resources Canada, over the Prime Minister's office.
Indeed, after Trudeau became Prime Minister in 2015, he flew to Europe and announced he would cut Canada's greenhouse emissions by about 30% by 2030.
Canada is back, my good friends. We're here to help, to build an agreement that will do our children and our grandchildren proud.
But since then, Trudeau has pushed for three new pipelines for the oil sands, and critics say he's taken no steps to curb emissions from the oil and gas sector, which produces more than one quarter of all of Canada's greenhouse gases.
Canada's been trying to deal with the issue of climate change for almost 20 years now, but to this day we don't have any federal climate policies that directly target the oil and gas industry.
Adam Scott is a campaigner with Oil Change International in Toronto.
There's been numerous times when the federal government has said, okay, we're going to deal with climate change, we're going to put, you know, modest regulation in place for emissions. And we've seen time and time again where suddenly the government one minute is talking about doing climate policy and the next minute it's gone.
While the concept of the deep state has been embraced by Donald Trump and the alt-right, it's a term that's historically been used to describe entrenched corporate, military, or national security power in countries like Turkey, Egypt, and the United States.
But I wanted to give it a little bit of academic structure. So I linked it to the notion of institutional capture, which has a very long history in literature, in which agencies of one kind or another set up to serve the public interest, regulators or government departments or so on, end up serving the private interest instead of the public interest.
Taft argues that when governments are captured by corporate interests such as oil companies, elections become more meaningless.
When that happens, democracy stops being democratic. The state actually becomes, what you end up with is an appearance of democracy, but really it's a state within a state.
One way the oil industry gets its way is through its effective lobbying of government, especially by organizations like the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers.
The oil industry has a lot of clout in this country because they have some of the most influential lobbyists. They meet hundreds of times a year with federal officials.
Keith Stewart is an energy strategist with Greenpeace Canada in Toronto.
They have a political influence that is way larger than their actual economic influence. But I think part of what they've done is they've convinced government officials and many Canadians that they are a crucial part of the economy, when the reality is they're a small part.
Yet the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers says they are invited by government to offer their perspective on issues affecting the industry.
Our industry wants to engage with government as they're requesting. But a big part of what we do in engaging with governments is actually understanding what objectives the government's trying to achieve, what their reasons for wanting to achieve those objectives are, so that we can actually be a responsible stakeholder at the table.
Still, while the energy industry in Canada produces less than 7% of GDP and employs only 270,000 Canadians directly, it dominates policy at the federal level, and in particular the provincial governments of Alberta and Saskatchewan.
You know, this was really visible during the debate around Keystone XL in the U.S., where the oil industry was spending millions of dollars lobbying and advertising in Washington, D.C., and the federal government was as well. They were sending envoys from various departments and diplomats. They were spending government, you know, taxpayer dollars on advertising.
The result is that since 1997, when it signed the Kyoto Climate Accord, Canada has missed every target to cut emissions. Instead, since then, emissions have grown and remain at more than 700 megatons a year.
So Canada's actually promised to reduce our emissions at the same time as saying we're going to allow the oil and gas industry to grow substantially.
In Alberta, with the election of the NDP Rachel Notley government in 2015, the power of the oil industry was witnessed in how quickly the new premier became a champion of its interests.
Through her whole career and her whole party up until they became government, were very effective critics, counterbalances to the oil industry. As soon as she stepped into office, as soon as she and her party became government, they've simply become instruments of the oil industry, in my view.
While Notley introduced a carbon tax and is phasing out coal, she's permitting the oil industry to increase emissions by 40% above its current output. And she's fought for pipelines connecting the oil sands to ocean ports.
In real terms, Alberta is on track to dramatically increase its emissions in coming years, regardless of the fact that Alberta government has put in a suite of climate policies.
The Trudeau government has shown similar deference. It has so far reneged on its promise to cut $1.6 billion in subsidies to oil companies, has championed pipelines to the oil sands, and according to critics, not moved aggressively enough to curb the energy sector's greenhouse emissions.
So as it stands today, the Trudeau government is on track to fail on a couple of its major policy initiatives because of the power of the oil and gas industry to control this narrative.
Today, Kevin Taft says that unless Canada breaks the power and influence of the oil industry, we will be left behind in the race to build an economy based on renewables. And time is running out. Leading climate scientists are saying that passing the threshold of a 2 degrees increase in global temperatures by 2050 or sooner is looking more assured than ever.
Canada's made itself a laggard in the transition to moving away from from fossil fuel energy. And we are vulnerable because we've hitched ourselves to yesterday's technology or to the last century's technology. And the world is moving very rapidly away from that, as they have to. For our own sake, we have to. We've allowed our leaders to become captured by one private interest, and it's going to hurt us badly.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. Now, I would say it's very well known by now that the capitalist drive for profit is indeed pushing the world towards climate catastrophe. You know, and the drive for endless expansion is pushing the world towards environmental devastation. It's well known that indigenous people and their allies, both in this country and around the world, are fighting back to defend their lands against the extractive industries threatening to devastate them, and they're fighting for survival, basically. It's well known that this struggle is an anti-colonial struggle. But it goes beyond that. I mean, we just had the anniversary of the U.S. Empire's 2003 invasion of Iraq, just this past week, in which a million people were killed. We just had the anniversary of the 1999 bombing of Yugoslavia and the devastation of yet another country at the hands of U.S. imperialism. We just had the anniversary of the 2011 destruction of Libya, which used to be the wealthiest country in Africa. Now it's been reduced to ruins and a society where slavery has been reintroduced. You know, we've seen the U.S. Empire's military occupation of 25% of the land area of Syria. We've seen its renewed threats to destroy independent countries like Iran and the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. We've seen the contamination of countries like Iraq, Libya, Syria, and Serbia by the depleted uranium weapons used by the U.S. Empire, and the after effects, the catastrophic after effects of this, these cancer-producing weapons will be with us for millions of years to come. Like literally millions of years of increased cancer rates, leukemia, all manner of health problems in these societies, birth defects. I think it's safe to say that that anti-colonialism and anti-colonial struggle remain the chief political task of our time, if humanity is to have a future at all. And all these things go together. You know, these things don't stand apart. You know, if we want to defend the land, we want to defend like the soil and the water and all this sort of stuff. All that goes in hand with opposing things like capitalism, opposing colonialism, opposing imperialism. Because those are the things that drive environmental devastation. Those are the things that drive the destruction of whole peoples, whole nations, and ways of life. Many of the necessary connections have not been made in people's minds when it comes to these things. But perhaps this poem, written by the then journalist William Pepper, who bore witness to the horrors being inflicted upon the people of Vietnam in 1966-67, being inflicted upon the people of Vietnam by the American Empire, and its brutal war in that country. Brutal war on that country, I should say. Perhaps this poem will make things clearer. I come and stand at every door, but no one hears my silent plea. I stand and yet remain unseen, for I am dead. For I am dead. I am only 7, though I died in my lie. Long ago, I'm 7 now as I was then. When children die, they do not grow. My hair was scorched by swirling flame. My eyes grew dim, my eyes grew blind. Death came and turned my bones to dust that was scattered by the wind. All that I ask is but for peace. You fight today, you fight today, so that the children of this world may live and grow and laugh and play. And the children of My Lai, and their mothers, and their grandparents, were of course slaughtered by American soldiers in March 1968, which is yet another grim anniversary of colonial brutality that we mark this month. You know, one of many, which I just listed. When previous generations witnessed the devastation of Vietnam by Agent Orange, which of course was manufactured by Dow Chemical, by Agent Orange chemical defoliant in Pentagon's Operation Hades, that's literally what they called this operation, to spray defoliant all over the jungles of Vietnam to, you know, so that the Viet Cong and the National Resistance Force fighters who were fighting against the American invasion and occupation of their land, who were fighting for the independence of their land, so they wouldn't have no cover, basically. You know, so they sprayed this defoliant all over the place, devastating the landscape, devastating the food chain, the ecosystem, everything. Back then, the link between imperialism and environmental catastrophe was laid bare for all to see. But nowadays, too many of the environmental activists who stand in solidarity with indigenous land defenders in BC do not stand at the same time with the Syrian people in their resistance against the American Empire that is both occupying and devastating their land, just as it did to Libya and Iraq. When peoples and governments of the Third World resist imperialism today, Western activists are too often either silent or fall back upon spurious legal arguments as opposed to expressing genuine solidarity. For example, liberal anti-war activists continue to make a big deal out of how the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was sold to the American people on the basis of false claims of the country possessing weapons of mass destruction. The implication being that if there actually were weapons of mass destruction, it would have been okay to go in there and pulverize that country. Liberals like to make the same argument about the Tonkin Gulf incident in Vietnam and the Vietnam War, making one of the bloodiest colonial wars in history out to be a simple mistake rather than a crime of shocking proportions. You know, they, of course, they've done the same with Iraq. And unfortunately, today there is no radical mass anti-war movement that makes anti-imperialism its core commitment, unlike the days in the Vietnam War. And of course, we also have like liberal activists who are taken in by the propaganda around Syria and stuff like that, which of course demonizes the Syrian government, demonizes, you know, the Syrian people who are fighting back against colonialism, and it demonizes them, you know, saying, oh yeah, they're using chemical weapons on their people. Of course, they never provide any evidence of that, but they make these allegations. They make allegations about massacres, which never happened. They claim that the forces the U.S. is backing and which are just devastating that country, the various militant groups, which are foreign-backed and foreign-funded and foreign-armed and all that sort of stuff, that somehow they make them out to be the heroes, when of course they're not. They're the most brutal, murderous forces on the planet, really. You know, just as the forces that the U.S. were backing in Iraq, just as the forces that they were backing in Nicaragua and in Guatemala, in El Salvador, in, you know, in Bosnia, in Vietnam, all these places where the U.S. has gone in there and just backed to the hilt the most murderous right-wing reactionary forces in a society and reinforced them in many cases with foreign fighters, bringing in people, bringing in weapons, bringing in, like, you know, their own personnel in some cases, you know, all this sort of stuff. And then they try to make it to be some sort of humanitarian pro-democracy kind of operation, which, of course, is nothing of the kind. It's an imperialist operation. It's a colonial operation designed to destroy the independence of a sovereign nation. That's what it always is. You know, this is the kind of thing that's going on now. It's going on around all over the world. It has to be opposed. It has to be fought back. It has to be just, you know, that kind of imperialism has to be exposed and fought against. I mean, what the CIA defector John Stockwell outlines in the following discussion from 1988 is truer now than ever. And so I want to play this clip of him. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
My expertise, as you know, is CIA, Marine Corps, three CIA secret wars. I had a position in the National Security Council in 1975 as the chief of the Angola task force running the secret war in Angola. It was the third CIA secret war I was part of. The national security law creating the National Security Council and the CIA, as you know, was passed in 1947. The CIA was given this charter to perform such other duties and function as might be necessary to the national security interests, and given a vague authority to protect its sources and methods. And I think it was in the mid-80s that I coined this phrase, the Third World War, because in my research I realized that we were not attacking the Soviet Union and the CIA's activities. We were attacking people in the Third World. And I'm going to just quickly, in the interest of time, just give you a little sense of what that means, this Third World War. Basically, it's the third, I believe, in terms of loss of life and human destruction, the third bloodiest war in all of history. They undertake to run operations in every corner of the globe. They also undertook the license of operating just totally above and beyond U.S. laws. They had a license, if you will, to kill, but also they took that to a license to smuggle drugs, a license to do all kinds of things to other people in other societies in violation of international law, our law, and every principle of nations working together for a healthier and more peaceful world. Meanwhile, again, they battled to convert the U.S. legal system in such a way that it would give them control of our society. Now, we have massive documentation of what they call the secret wars of the CIA. We don't have to guess or speculate. We had the Church Committee investigate them in 1975, gave us our first really in-depth, powerful look inside this structure. Senator Church said in the 14 years before he did his investigation that he found they had run 900 major operations and 3,000 minor operations. And if you extrapolate that over the whole period of the 40-odd years that we've had a CIA, you come up with 3,000 major operations and over 10,000 minor operations. Every one of them illegal, every one of them disruptive of the lives and societies of other peoples, and many of them bloody and gory beyond comprehension almost. Extensively, we manipulated and organized the overthrow of functioning constitutional democracies in other countries. We organized secret armies and directed them to fight in just about every continent in the world. We encouraged ethnic minorities to rise up and fight, people like the Mosquito Indians in Nicaragua, the Kurds in the Middle East, the Hmongs in Southeast Asia. We have organized and we still do and fund death squads in countries around the world, like the Treasury Police in El Salvador, which are responsible for most of the killing of the 50,000 people just in the 80s, and there was 70,000 before that. And orchestration, CIA secret teams, and propaganda led us directly into the Korean War. We were attacking China from the islands Kaimoi, Matsu, Thailand, Tibet. A lot of drug trafficking involved in this, by the way, until eventually we convinced ourselves to fight the Chinese in Korea, and we had the Korean War, and 1 million people were killed. Same thing for the Vietnam War, and we have extensive documentation of how the CIA was involved at every level, or the national security complex, because it's a very cooperative thing, into manipulating the nation into the Vietnam War. And we wound up creating the Golden Triangle, in which the CIA, Air America airplanes, were flying in arms to our allies and flying back out with the heroin. We launched the largest, this is something that Jimmy Carter did, Admiral Turner brags about it, the operation in Afghanistan. Biggest single operation, I'm told, in the history of the CIA's secret wars. And sure enough, very quickly we produced the Golden Crescent, which is still the largest source of heroin perhaps in the world today. Trying to summarize this Third World War that the CIA, the U.S. National Security Complex, with the military all interwoven in it in many different ways, has been waging. Let me just put it this way. The best heads that I coordinate with studying this thing, we count at least minimum figure 6 million people who've been killed in this long 40-year war that we've waged against the people of the Third World. These are not Soviets. We have not been parachuting teams into the Soviet Union to kill and hurt and maim people, especially not since 1954, when they developed actually a capability of dropping atomic weapons on the United States. They aren't British French, Swedes, Swiss, Belgians. We don't do bloody gory operations in the countries of Europe. These are all people of the third world. They're people of countries like the Congo, Vietnam, Kampuchea, Indonesia, Nicaragua, where conspicuously they nor their governments do not have the capability of doing any physical hurt to the United States. They don't have ICBMs, they don't have armies or navies. They could not hurt us if they wanted to. There has rarely been any evidence that they really wanted to. And that, in fact, is perhaps the whole point. If they had had ICBMs, we probably wouldn't have done the things to them for fear of retaliation. Cheap shots, if you will, killing people of other countries of the world who cannot defend themselves under the guise of secrecy and under the rubric of national security.
So you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was John Stockwell, a man who used to be, who was once in the CIA, actually a very high-ranking member of the CIA in the 1960s and 1970s, and who actually ran secret CIA operations in Vietnam and in Southern Africa, where, of course, he was the chief of the Angola task force, as he said, involved in the destabilization of the revolutionary government in Angola. And in an operation like that, I actually did read this man's book, In Search of Enemies, where he details how the U.S. worked with apartheid South Africa, how it armed the most right-wing reactionary forces in Angolan society to destabilize and basically tear the country apart in order to prevent a socialist government from emerging, prevent a revolutionary order to emerge that would, you know, allow the people of Angola to control their own resources, their own territory, actually exercise self-determination in the face of multinational corporations and in the face of global capitalism. You know, this is the kind of stuff the CIA does. This is the kind of stuff the American government as a whole really does around the world. Suppressing sovereign governments, suppressing anyone who fights back against capitalism, and the multinational corporations and the Fortune 500 and all that. You know, this is why they suppress sovereign governments like Libya and Iraq and Syria and places like this. You know, why they went to such great lengths to oppose the Soviet Union and China and all these, and the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and all these countries that have tried to build the kind of society where, you know, the people of those countries exercise self-determination and control their own resources, their own economy, and, you know, exercise full sovereignty. You know, they don't even have to be socialist necessarily, or communist, or any of that sort of thing, because, of course, Syria was not, Iraq was not, and Libya was not. They just have to exercise self-determination, control their own resources, and go their own way when it comes to foreign policy. Have, like, their own foreign policy. It's not determined by the United States or the great powers of the world. These are the kind of countries that are targeted. You know, these are the kind of countries that are targeted for destruction, for undermining, for sabotage. And, of course, this has terrible human costs every time this happens. And, of course, we saw that in Iraq. We saw that in Syria. We saw that in Libya. We saw that in Yugoslavia. All these kind of, all in Vietnam, where you had the My Lai massacre. You know, all these kind of cases. You know, you saw the kind of devastation that imperialism, the colonialism, engages in around the world. And, of course, its goal is to constantly expand profits for the Fortune 500, for the capitalist system as a whole, to constantly grow the profits, expand them. And to do that, it has to trample on and exploit people all over the world, just like it does in Burnaby, BC, you know, trampling on people, stealing land from indigenous people. This is the kind of modus operandi that capitalism, that imperialism pursues all over the world. This is what it does, and that's what John Stockwell was talking about. This guy who basically was in the CIA, he was doing this stuff, and then he left the CIA and basically blew the whistle on what they were doing. And a little later on, we're going to hear from Philip Agee, who is another CIA insider who then defected and went public with the kind of crimes that they were engaged in. Now, What I want to do right now is I want to play a clip by from Press TV's correspondent Muhammad Ali from Damascus, Syria, discussing quite a monumental thing which happened today, just today, in the conflict in Syria. It was the liberation of the Harasta suburb of eastern Ghouta from foreign-backed militants. In contrast to Western media lies, the Syrian army and the Syrian people have been taking their country back from the Western-trained and Western-funded terrorist groups. And whenever civilians have been involved, you know, whether that was in Aleppo or in eastern Ghouta or other places where, you know, like the civilian population has been in the combat zone has been considerable, they have opened humanitarian corridors to get them out, to get them out of the combat zone. The Syrian army has rescued about almost 100,000 people from the terrorist-held parts of eastern Ghouta over the past week alone. You know, they're not massacring people. They're not using indiscriminate force. Their goal is to defeat the Western-backed colonial project in their country and to protect the Syrian people, and they are doing just that. The battle in eastern Ghouta is currently winding down, and its full liberation is expected very soon. This is something all opponents of colonialism should celebrate. And that's what Muhammad Ali's report here is about. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Now joining us live from eastern Ghouta is our correspondent Muhammad Ali to give us an update. Thank you very much, Muhammad Ali. Can you tell us what's happening?
Yes, the town of Harasta is now a terrorist-free town after the terrorists of Ahrar al-Sham left, of course, along with their families. For 2 days, terrorists have been leaving on buses. Today, in the evening, the last bus carrying terrorists left over there. The overall number of buses that transported the terrorists and their families was 80 buses, transporting 4,386 persons. Among them, there were 1,403 terrorists. They left towards northern Syria, particularly Idlib, and now Harasta is completely under the full control of the Syrian army. Army troops entered the town and started removing the mines and explosive devices left behind by the terrorists. Of course, the terrorists, before leaving and in implementation of the deal signed with the Syrian government, they handed over the heavy and medium weapons to the Syrian army. Also, there was an exchange of prisoners, and now Harasta is completely free of terrorist groups. Also, there was another deal that was made between the Syrian government and the terrorist groups of Faylaq al-Rahman, in addition to al-Nusra Front. Those will be also leaving four major strongholds inside eastern al-Ghouta, four towns, Zamalka, Arbin, Ain Terma and Drobar, starting from tomorrow, according to the reports we're getting from that area. This is a significant development over here in eastern Al-Ghouta. This is a militant-held region that has been occupied by terrorists, various terrorist groups, for over 6 years, since 2012. And now, because of the Syrian army's military operations against the terrorists there since last month, the terrorists have accepted such deals in order to exit towards Idlib without a fight. What remains in eastern Al-Ghouta is actually Douma. We still have to wait and see what will happen regarding Douma, which used to be considered by the terrorists over there as the so-called capital of that militant-held region. There's also a deal over there with the terrorists in Douma, particularly the so-called Jaish al-Islam, a Saudi-backed armed group considered by the West as so-called moderate opposition group. 3,500 kidnapped civilians and army personnel who are believed to be in the prisons of this terrorist organization in Douma will be freed, according to a deal also reached with the Syrian government. Starting from tomorrow, we might be witnessing the evacuation and the exit and the release of those kidnapped persons from Douma. So this is a very important also development that the families of those kidnapped are waiting for over 6 years now over there. Eastern Al-Ghouta is occupies about an area of about 116 square kilometers. The Syrian government is for the first time now entering those areas after terrorists are leaving. 7,000 individuals, including, of course, terrorists, will be also leaving from those four areas, Arbin, Zamalka, Ain Terma, and Jobar, tomorrow if the deal continues to be successful.
Now, Muhammad Ali, you mentioned all of these different sections of Eastern Ghouta. According to reports, I assume that about 90% of Eastern Ghouta is now under the control of the Syrian army. How far along are we from an end to this whole offensive and seeing Eastern Ghouta completely freed of terrorists?
Yes, after this deal that was reached just in the evening with the so-called Faylaq al-Rahman and those four major towns, when those terrorists leave those areas, yes, about 90% will be secured and terrorist-free of Eastern al-Ghouta, the militant-held region. What will remain is only Douma. Douma, one of the biggest towns occupied by the so-called Jaysh al-Islam, the Saudi-backed terrorist group over there. This will only remain over there in Eastern al-Ghouta, where terrorists are present. Perhaps we might be witnessing another similar deal for the evacuation of the terrorists inside. It is not expected that we might be seeing any kind of future military operations inside those areas around Douma in particular, which remains only alone under the occupation of terrorists, because now the terrorists there are fully encircled by the Syrian army, and they know that they have no chance of surviving if they want to keep fighting against the Syrian army. So after the evacuation of all those terrorist groups, Ahrar al-Sham, Faylaq al-Rahman, and the al-Nusra Front, Jaysh al-Islam is now alone, fully encircled by the Syrian army in Douma. So we're expecting that there will be no more fighting inside that area, and that there will be a future deal that will also lead to the evacuation of terrorists there.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Muhammad Ali, giving us live updates from Eastern Ghouta in Syria.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So that was Muhammad Ali's report from Damascus on the liberation of the Harasta suburb in Eastern Ghouta. And this really is the strategy that is pursued by the Syrian army. Basically, what they do is when they... when they're dealing with, once again, a very populated area that is held by terrorist groups, what they do is they will surround that area, open humanitarian corridors while they launch their offensive against the terrorist group so that people can get out. For quite some time, like during the assault on Eastern Ghouta, terrorist groups actually prevented people from leaving. You know, during the daily humanitarian pause, which took place basically between 9 a.m. and 2 p.m., on a daily basis, and actually still happens as the operations are ongoing, the military operations are ongoing. During that five-hour period, the terrorists would actually shoot mortars, use snipers, this sort of stuff, to basically keep civilians from getting away and getting to the government lines in Eastern Ghouta, you know, to prevent them from getting away. Because effectively they wanted these civilians to stay and use them as human shields. This is something that is actually very real in Eastern Ghouta, even though I've talked about in the past, like how when the Israelis, for example, the Israeli government tried to demonize Hamas in Gaza for using human shields, that was fake. That was propaganda. That was thoroughly debunked. But in the case of Eastern Ghouta, and this was also the case with regard to Aleppo, these guys actually would, these militant groups, these Western-backed militant groups, you know, they would actually shoot at civilians, prevent civilians from leaving, you know, and, you know, use deadly force to keep civilians terrorized and staying in the same place in an effort to try to discourage the Syrian army from advancing. Needless to say, it got to the point in Eastern Ghouta where they could not do that anymore. The Syrian army advanced enough. They managed to break through these terrorist lines, and they were able to liberate enough where the civilians actually could get out. You know, there was no way for the terrorists to prevent them from doing so. And when they could get out, tens of thousands of them, that's exactly what they did. They got away. They got to the, then there were you know, facilities open for them, you know, like medical care, education, all this stuff. Like, they had housing ready for them. When they got away, the Syrian government provided those things. And that's what's been going on. And more people get out every day. And it's and of course they've now put in place this deal because of course the terrorist groups they're surrounded, they realize they can't win. So what the Syrian government has made a deal with them, so they will evacuate those terrorist groups. Those terrorist groups will leave for the north of the country, those areas in the north of the country where in Idlib province and places like that, which are still under the control of terrorist groups up by the border with Turkey. They will leave for those areas. They will leave Damascus. They will leave the Eastern Ghouta region, and they will leave. and the area there in Eastern Ghouta will be liberated by the Syrian army, without further bloodshed. So that's basically what's been going on, and none of this really makes it into the Western press at all, because all they want to do is make basically false claims of chemical attacks which have no basis in reality, or claims of indiscriminate force which simply is not backed up by the evidence, and they're basically just demonizing the Syrian government for fighting back and resisting the Western imperialist agenda, which is very strong in Syria, which they've tried to break that government down, they've tried to break the country up, they've occupied a large chunk of the country, U.S. forces occupying 25% of the northeast of the country, the area north of the Euphrates River. On the pretext of fighting ISIS. But of course, ISIS is mostly gone now, and they're still occupying that region and have no plans on withdrawing. So now it has become a military occupation of Syrian land by the United States and its proxies on the ground. That's what's really going on there. That's what, colonialism is what is happening in Syria right now. By the U.S., by Turkey, which is occupying other areas in the north of Syria. And of course, by Israel, which, of course, is continuing occupying the Golan Heights in defiance of international law. There's all these parts of Syrian land that are now occupied by foreign powers, effectively. And this is very much colonialism, and it's not really recognized by nearly as, all the people who should recognize it for what it is. Way too many people don't really know what's going on in the West, and that's basically through media disinformation. Is the reason why they don't understand what really is happening in Syria. So it's very important to understand. So anyway, I'm going to take a bit of a break and come back after the short break here on Back in the USSR. Please stay tuned.
You're listening to the CFRU 93.3 FM.
If you had the opportunity to save a life, would you take it? Sounds like a no-brainer, right? And yet only 31% of people in Ontario have registered their consent to donate their organs and tissue in the event of their death. That means, on average, one person will die every 3 days because an organ is not available to save them. By registering, you have the opportunity to save as many as 8 people's lives through organ donation and to improve the quality of life for up to 75 people through tissue donation. If you want to become a donor, go to beadonor.ca. Take 2 minutes to register your consent to save a life. And don't forget to share your wishes with your family afterwards. In the words of Mike Willis, a very grateful heart recipient,
"If someone hadn't registered their consent to donate, I would not be alive today."
Tune in Wednesdays 9 to 11 a.m. for The Stillness and the Dancing, a quiet corner of ambient, drone, modern classical, and experimental beauty. If you're looking to find some solace in a chaotic world, there's no better show to stay in bed for. That's The Stillness and the Dancing every Wednesday morning, 9 to 11 a.m. here on CFRU 93.3 in Guelph.
Do you have questions about sexual health strategies? Do you want to know your HIV-STI status and get tested? Every Wednesday, HIV-AIDS Resources and Community Health offers free HIV-STI testing that is anonymous and confidential. You don't need an appointment. They screen for HIV, syphilis, and gonorrhea, and depending on the risk factors and results, they can book follow-up appointments for other tests. If your HIV test is negative, you will know within just 20 minutes. If it is positive, they will conduct another test just to be certain. Come check them out at their accessible location at Speedvale in Dawson, or get more info at archguelph.ca/testing.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. Now, like I said earlier, when I played the clip by John Stockwell, the former member of the CIA who then defected and basically went public with all the horrendous operations that the CIA was engaged in, and he went public in the late 1970s with that, and was very much involved politically as an activist, anti-imperialist activist, ever since that time, throughout the 1980s and 90s. And another man who was, even before Stockwell left the CIA and went public, and basically stood against the colonial imperial structure, power structure that the U.S. government was imposing on the world, was Philip Agee, who in 1974 actually